The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Today is Donald Trump's so-called Liberation Day, where he's set to announce a raft of new tariffs. Any tariffs could have a negative impact on Eurozone inflation and the cutting of interest rates, which has been ongoing since last June. They also come against the backdrop of Russia's continuing war in Ukraine and Europe having to scale up defence spending. All of these issues will be under consideration by the European Central Bank when it convenes to decide on any further interest rate cuts in the coming months. It's quite a hefty agenda for the Central Bank to discuss, and I'm delighted to be joined in studio by the President of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde. Madam President, good morning and welcome.
Bonjour, Godpot.
A couple of fuckle good. That means you have a few words. Madam President, you're here to accept the Sutherland Award, which is one of the awards presented by Business and Finance in association with KPMG. Did you know Peter?
I met Peter once. It was way back when he was in his GATT days, before he became head of WTO. Or at the time when he became head of WTO, and I was a lawyer back then. I was in private practice, and we had set up the European Law Centre in Brussels, and he was our first guest as a speaker, and he was just brilliant. I had the privilege to introduce him because I was head of that centre, and we were just all in awe with him. The girls were all in love with him, actually.
He was charming.
Oh my goodness, yes, he was charming, but he was so bright and so. So perky and funny as well. He had a great sense of humor. Yeah.
So this award, the Sutherland Award, is meaningful to you?
Absolutely. I feel extremely honored and privileged. I'm not sure that I deserve it, but I'll
do
my best.
You're in very good company in terms of the recipients of this award. But he was a great European.
Oh my God. Yes. Peter. Yes.
I mean, he from Ireland's point of view, he was our first and foremost European, I suppose. But anyway, let's talk about Liberation Day. And from the point of view of the European Central Bank, things were going so well, weren't they? Inflation was under control. The interest rates were coming down. Things were right on track.
Well, I would say that we have a mission, and that mission is to procure price stability to the economy so that people understand what the price levels is and how it's going to move over the course of time, so they can make their investment, consumption, mortgage decisions, understanding what the deal is. And we had come from very high inflation that was precipitated by a combination of shocks that came, one after the other and compounded each other. And we are now very close to target. So the disinflationary process is well underway. We are not quite at target yet. There is still a bit of work to do, but we are quite satisfied with the work that we have done.
The prediction was that this year there might be a little bump in the road. Yeah. This is before Liberation Day. Yeah. There might be a little bump in the road, and then things would get back down to 2% by 2027?
Yeah, the target we have is 2% in the medium term on a sustainable basis. We have been under 2% previously, yep. But it went up again because we have base effects, which are generally determined by the price of energy, which matters a lot, or price of food matters a lot, of course. But yes, we will have little bumps up. But I think what matters is this sort of medium-term approach and sustainable 2% that we want to reach. And I really think that with the work that we've done with, first of all, hiking interest rate to fight inflation and bring it down, and now cutting interest rates as we have by 150 basis points, so 1.5% down, we are, as I said, I think close to target.
And it's good for business, obviously.
I think it's good for all, It's also good for consumers, for households. When you go shopping, you're interested in the price you pay. When you go to the petrol station, you're interested in how much you pay for it as well.
Now, one of the drivers of prosperity and good business is predictability. I mean, knowing where you stand, whether the interest rates are high or low, you factor all of that in your planning, whether it's household planning or national planning or business planning. When you're dealing with the United States in this very unpredictable world, it makes your task far more difficult.
Mm. Well, predictability is in very short supply at the moment, for sure. And I don't think that I have ever mentioned the word uncertainty as many times as I have in the last few weeks, because we simply don't really know to this day, which is supposed to be the day when it is announced, what the deal will be for the rest of the world. But what we know, Pat, is that it will not be good for the global economy. And it will not be good for those who inflict the rates and all those who retaliate. I mean, it's going to unsettle the trade world as we know it. And I think Peter Sutherland would turn in his grave if he knew what is going on
at the moment. As one of the architects of globalization.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, we quoted from Ronald Reagan yesterday on the program where he said tariffs, first of all, they have a role to play, maybe in one particular sector or another at any given time. But anyone who creates blanket tariffs is shooting a hole in the boat. And anyone who responds...
Is that Reagan who said
Reagan
that?
Reagan said that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes,
okay.
And anyone who responds is yeah. shooting a second hole in the boat. Mm. And it's so stupid to do that kind of thing. Mm. So how should Europe respond? Do you reciprocate?
That is something for the political leaders to decide. Our job at the central bank is to anticipate, to explain to them, although they do have great economists as well, what the consequences will be in terms of economic economic impact. And I was going to say negative impact because it will be negative anyway, the world over. And it will have an impact. And the density and the durability of the impact will vary depending on the scope, on the products targeted, on how long it lasts, on whether or not there are negotiations. Because let's not forget, quite often, those escalation of tariffs, because they prove harmful, even for those who inflict it, lead to negotiation tables where people actually sit down and discuss and eventually remove some of those barriers.
Now, you have said that, I think yesterday, I think is the speech yeah. I'm quoting from, Trump's tariffs offer a chance for Europe to show independence.
Absolutely. I called it the beginning of a march towards independence.
What does that independence mean?
Okay. What I mean by that is we should not be exclusively focused on what is happening on the other side of the pond. And we should focus on the strength that we have at home and how we can regain a degree of independence that we don't have. And that applies to defense. It applies to trade, of course. It applies to finance. And from my perspective, it applies to the way money moves around Europe. So by that, I mean capital markets, which are completely scattered all over Europe and which have to be better organized, more consolidated, converging and possibly singly supervised. That's one thing. The second thing, which I think is really important for all of us, is to have digital payment under our control. When you think of it at the moment, a lot of our digital payment, when you pay, you know, when you e-commerce or peer-to-peers or you use your card or your phone, you always rely on non-European infrastructure. So I think the controlling
explain
our digital
that to me,
payment.
Because I wasn't aware of this.
Think about
I presumed
it.
We were
yeah.
all...
Whether you use a card
yeah.
Or whether you use a phone,
yeah.
typically it goes through Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Alipay. Where are all those coming from? Well, either the US or China. And the whole sort of infrastructure mechanism that allows for the payment, credit and debit, is not
I'm a
European
bit concerned
solution.
About this. I didn't realize this because it means that every time I use my credit card or use my phone, that information about me is leaving the European Union and
Absolutely.
Going to the United States. I thought
Absolutely.
That was not permitted.
And I'm sure they do that, you know, in compliance with European regulations. But yes, that is the point, which is where I think that we have to reduce that vulnerability and make sure that there is a European offer that is available just in case. You never know.
All right, a plan B.
Yeah.
Now, the question of investment in Europe, if I had billions of euro or dollars at my disposal, I'm looking at the United States. Would I put my money in there at the moment or would I look for somewhere else to invest where predictability was more the norm?
What we observe on the markets at the moment and in capital flows is a lot less excitement about investing in the US. I'm not saying that the flows have reversed and that it's all coming back to Europe. No. But there is at the moment a stop and hold until there is more certainty about those markets. So that's another reason why I think this march towards independence is important. We have to make sure that in the European Union, in the euro area, we have attractive investments that people want to put their money in. And we have the assets, we have the opportunities to do that. Think for a second, if we were to remove the internal barriers that we have set for ourselves in Europe, our economic wealth would increase significantly. The IMF has produced some studies about that, and it's clear that our own barriers internally at the moment, in services, for instance, equal to 110% tariffs, in goods equal to 40% tariffs. We have to remove that.
But isn't that a political decision that would have to be made by the European Union?
Yes.
And we know, and I don't expect you to comment on the rogue or the couple of rogues among the EU27 who are pro-Putin and who would not like to see any of this consolidation and, I suppose, efficiency creation.
Mm. I believe that European leaders who are truly dedicated to that European project will find the ways institutionally to agree amongst themselves, whether it takes the form of a coalition of the willing, of qualified majority or otherwise, but they have to find the ways.
We quoted something else a couple of days ago on the programme, which is a joke that goes round in Kyiv particularly. And it's a question really, and I'm only doing this from memory. How come 450 million Europeans require the help of 340 million Americans to defend themselves against 130 million Russians?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting question.
I think it's the point that was made by Donald Tusk. He brought in as well the 350 Americans and the 500 million Europeans. And it goes exactly to the point that I was making. We do have the strength. We do have the economic power. We do have the potential. We do have the population. I'm not sure we have the perfect demographics, which raises the issue of how do we deal with shortage of labor. But we have those huge assets, and we need to apply that those capacities and that creativity that we have to be more independent and to be less vulnerable on all fronts.
How does that come about?
When there is a will, there is a way. And I think that in times of crisis, whether it's in Ireland or whether it's in Europe, we have found the ways to bounce back from where we were, whether it was vulnerability or financial crisis, to come back and to restore our position. And I think we are in this moment in Europe where, because we are confronted to a significant risk, we have to draw on our forces and to draw on our unity. That's a difficult point, by the way.
Now, you know that Trump's idea is he'll have blanket tariffs on all European nations, and then he wants to have individual conversations with individual leaders to try and, you know, do the deal with each one of them individually. And that would be, I suppose, to divide and conquer.
That's an old practice, isn't it?
Yes.
It goes back to the Roman days. Yeah. You know, there is a lot of uncertainty as to exactly where he's going to come out, whether it's going to be a blanket tariff or whether it's going to be already targeted in such a way that he can already divide by sheer announcement, or whether it's going to be sectorial, whether it's going to be on the basis of reciprocity. There are many schools of thought, but I think he's the only one to know what he wants to implement. I want to spend all my time and all my energy and my vigor on what we can do for ourselves and how we can be stronger and better at home.
One of the things that is going to happen is already signaled, and particularly in Germany, where the constraints on spending money on defence have now been lifted, there will be a massive investment in European defence.
Mm-hmm.
And in a perverse way, you know, the weapons of war will be good for economies.
The jury is out, because it depends how it is spent and where we purchase. If that European money or member states' money is spent on equipment, on research and development, on new weapons and da-da-da, which I'm not an expert in, by the way, that will produce, you know, innovation, productivity gains, and all that is good for the economy. Particularly if it is purchased within Europe, not outside Europe.
But of course, this might be part of the deal that Trump wants to do. Increase your defence spending and buy it from us.
He might try that, for sure. Which is why, again, I'm coming back to my point. We have to build our resources. We have to build our capacity at home.
Looking at
which might take time. But it's a long game that we should play.
Your analysis and the central bank's analysis of the American economy and its structural deficits. I was listening to Yanis Varoufakis. I'm sure you know him well.
Yes.
From back in the day. Yesterday on our station, he was talking about the problem for America is their manufacturing capability has diminished dramatically. Mm. And yet they are wealthier than ever in terms of the dollar. And that the people around Trump, what they really want to do is devalue the dollar. There'll be lots of people with dollars then who will want to shed them. And then they will try to persuade them to buy long-term American bonds. Mm. With that cash. But the dollar goes down in value, which makes American exports more competitive. Is that a logical analysis?
I don't think it works, in the textbook, because there are a few obstacles along the way. And I'm not sure that this is even any longer the plan. I think the key plan at the moment is more short term. It's let's raise tariffs to cash in order to allow for the tax cuts that will be coming up later in the year. I think that's the short-term plan. The medium-term plan is bring industry back at home, which is also an issue because if you have a labor supply, which is largely available, fine. But if you are short on labor, it's likely to heat up the economy, which is not something that anybody wants when you're trying to reduce inflation.
Do you despair a bit of what's going on in the United States? I mean, I look at it and I think of these barons from the 19th century in Victorian times, very wealthy people being influenced.
Them the robber barons,
robber
right?
Robber barons,
yes. Yeah.
Of the 19th century. And we also have an anti-science bias in the United States. Yeah. We have children in Florida age 14 and upwards being encouraged to work at nights to compensate for the migrants. It's like going back to the 19th century, to Victorian times. It is depressing.
It is very worrying. It is very. But I never despair of the American people. You know, I have a debt to the American people. I went to the US when I was 17 after the death of my father. I have an American family and many American people are wonderful and warm-hearted people. And I cannot believe that they're all sympathetic to what is happening at the moment.
But they don't have a chance until November of next year to have their say, although they did, as you probably saw overnight in Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Which will. This was Musk talking about the impact of that single election could impact the entire world. Which, on the face of it, was quite bizarre.
Hyperbolic.
Hyperbolic. Exactly so. So your ambition then for the central bank, do you have unity in the central bank? I mean, are you, you smiled there briefly when I asked that question.
I have around the table 26 super bright characters, most of them trained in economics, all of them sort of respected at home and responsible for their national central banks. And yet when they all come together around the table, we form one single unit, which is the euro system headed by the European Central Bank. So I spend a lot of my time talking to them, convincing them, working out what the consensus is likely to be on the basis of what I think is the best solution towards our target. I have the fantastic support of one of your compatriots, Philip Lane, who is my chief economist, a member of the executive board, and of fantastic advice and a great support to me in those endeavors. I work with Gabriel Maklouf, who is the National Central Bank governor at the moment. But the other 19 are as respectable and as smart and as good as.
Well, when I asked that question and you smiled, when you replied that there are 22 super bright people around the table, I smiled. Because I was trying to imagine the kind of conversations when you've got really bright people in the room and so many of them all trying to.
You know, I think what's really important is that they all feel respected, number one, listened to. And I don't think that we should ever have such a determined and stubborn view that their arguments are worth nothing. All arguments are worth being listened to, and some of them are worth being included in the reasoning and in the decisions that we make.
You know, when Michelle Obama was saying, when they go low, we go high.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, in response to what's going on in the world with Trump and with Putin, do we keep endeavoring to go high? For example, the Russian assets that are held by the ECB, which would more than compensate, well, partially compensate Ukraine for the damage inflicted upon Ukraine by Russia. Is there a case for just seizing those and giving them to Ukraine?
Number one, the good thing is that we have frozen those assets. So they belong to the National Central Bank of Russia, which is therefore Russia's sovereign property. Second, we are using them because the proceeds from those assets is used to pay back some of the loans that the G7 countries have extended to Ukraine. So it's being used.
So this money is earning interest.
Absolutely. And the interest is used to pay for those loans that have been made, as I said, by the G7 to Ukraine. My third point is that if you want international law to be respected, which is what we expect from all our, you know, partners, including Russia, which has clearly broken that rule. If we want the international law to be respected, we have to respect it ourselves. And there are conditions and circumstances when you can use those assets. They exist. They have been, validated by international law, and we should respect that. And we should, once the conditions are satisfied, in the right circumstances, of course, use those assets and apply it to the reconstruction of Ukraine, but not at, you know, under any circumstances and without conditions. It's for the reconstruction, part of a settlement agreement. And then you know what? It won't be enough to reconstruct Ukraine.
It will not.
More will be needed.
Yeah. Now, the question therefore is, why would anyone trust the European Central Bank if it did unilaterally seize those Russian assets?
Well, that's the other point.
Yeah.
And that's the point about international law. You were talking about unpredictability. We have to be predictable. And to be predictable, the rule of law matters. And international law matters. We need to abide by that.
We haven't talked about...
But at the end of the day, it will be for the leaders to decide, not for me. My job, again, is to remind them of what the consequences will be and what the principles are.
But you are the organization that is using the money, I presume.
We are remunerating the money, actually.
Yeah. Now, the question of China, we haven't mentioned it. Are you concerned that, you know, the biggest manufacturing power in the world, which it is at the moment, if you look at it as one unit, I mean, Europe might compete very successfully if you regarded Europe as a cohesive unit. Are you concerned that China's response may be negative for Europe in the terms of dumping stuff on the European market at discount prices to compensate for a loss of American trade?
Mm. Very good point. China has ramped up its place in the market, if you will. So they are now competing with us on a much larger category of products, products more than services. And yes, the sort of diversion of exports where China would actually come to Europe rather than the US because of the tariffs that have been erected on its way to China will have to be taken into account. Mm. They might very well try to do that. So we have to anticipate that movement. And I think that, again, leaders will have to
decide. It's interesting that China's already doing in Europe what Trump wants European automakers to do in America. Make cars in America. And China is attempting to build cars or is about to build cars in Europe and batteries and so on.
That's right.
Within the European Union.
That is right. They do that in some member states.
Mm-hmm. How do you manage to retain a sense of energy and optimism in the face of all the challenges?
I think that what fuels my energy is love, number one. The love that is given, the love that is received. And when in despair, I think of my grandchildren.
The world they are about to inherit.
Yep. And our duty to them.
Christine Lagarde, Madam President of the European Central Bank, thank you very much for joining us in studio this morning.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.